And here we are again. It's October 5th, 2025, if you're listening to this on the Sunday when it's being netcast and archived. This is Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, and I'm going to be throwing numerous newspaper story articles, mostly from mainstream media, I admit it, though maybe a few exceptions. And who knows, maybe some actual phoned interviews, one or two. Having trouble getting those at this late time, so I'm going to shovel this at you and hope that some of it sticks, or at least you find it interesting. But first, here's a little pins and needles for you to prick your awareness.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you.
So let's kick this off with a story from the San Francisco Chronicle from September 2nd, 2025. Headline is, San Francisco RV parking ban will force more people into the streets. This is an open forum editorial by Mike Little, who's an Uber driver in San Francisco, according to the byline. Mike writes, let's cut the crap by enacting strict new limits on recreational vehicle parking. San Francisco's leaders aren't managing a housing crisis, they're manufacturing one. By essentially making my RV illegal before offering a single legal place to go, City Hall is telling me and 1,400 others like me living in vehicles to disappear. I'm not a statistic, I'm a working resident, and the vehicle they want gone is the only thing keeping me from sleeping in a tent again. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, I ran a vacation rentals management company, but each shutdown hit me like a financial wrecking ball. Refunds for every booking, then new marketing costs every time things reopened. I survived three rounds of this whiplash, but by the fourth shutdown in November 2021, I was done. My income, savings, credit and home were stripped away. I was lucky to find someone willing to rent me a patch of backyard with access to power and a restroom. It wasn't pretty, but it was safe and cheap, a fragile foothold while I tried to claw back some stability. Eventually, I scraped enough money together to buy an RV. It has become my home, my office, my shot at rebuilding. These days, I park on Lake Merced Boulevard. Cars speed by all night, shaking the RV. It's noisy, stressful, and dangerous, but it's the only option left. According to San Francisco's 2024 point-in-time count, 8,323 people in the city are unhoused. Nearly 4,400 of them are living unsheltered on streets or in vehicles. Many are families, retirees, or people holding down jobs. The numbers keep climbing, even as the city spends hundreds of millions on homelessness, which raises the obvious question, if San Francisco can't house those already on the street, why push 1,400 more people into the same mess? The average one-bedroom in the city costs over $3,000 a month, pricing out anyone making under six figures. Affordable housing, quote-unquote, comes with decade-long wait lists. Shelters? The city has 4,200 beds, most with 90-day limits that reset the countdown back to the street. For people like me, an RV is the line between a locked door and a sidewalk. Safer than a tent, cheaper than rent, and the only foothold left in a city that priced us out years ago. Homeowners get stability, we get citations and tow trucks. In San Francisco, property buys protection, the rest of us are disposable. This summer, the Board of Supervisors passed a citywide 24/7 two-hour parking limit for large vehicles. The refuge permit in the law forces people into shelters or wait lists. The problem? The city has zero safe parking lots right now. The last one shut down earlier this year. Enforcement will hit before there's anywhere legal to go. Translation, 1,400 people will be told to move along with no place to move to. Now, I haven't heard the latest report on the so-called safe parking program in Santa Cruz. This is my addition to this story, my interruption. But I think it's if it's similar to what I heard from Evan Morrison, who runs the program, at least the Tier 3 program up at the Armory, which is probably the only really viable part of the program. You can actually park up there, come and go, unlike people who cannot go except on the transportation provided by the Armory itself. You're not allowed to drive up there. You're not allowed to have a friend come up to visit you in that way. Sometimes your communications are interfered with. We found that when a Huff member tried to give another Huff member who happened to be living at the Armory a time-sensitive letter to engage with his need to respond in time to keep his funding going. And he was threatened with arrest. That is, say, the individual showing up to deliver the letter to the resident up at the Armory. We've tried to talk with Evan Morrison about this. He's very amenable, very personable fellow, but he never does anything in terms of changing the rules or addressing the concerns that we brought up or the need to have some kind of real access so that this becomes more than simply a distant prison-like atmosphere. Anyway, getting back to the story, because the main point I'm making is that Santa Cruz does not have places to sleep in or park your vehicles to sleep in when you do have a vehicle. And those that it does provide supposedly on paper to satisfy the Coastal Commission, with whom it has close buddy-buddy relations, unfortunately, and so is able to really circumvent the social justice aspect of the law that should protect people who are in RVs and provide them access to the coast and save them from the laws that some coastal communities like Santa Cruz are passing in order to criminalize being in an RV or they call it an oversized vehicle, but it's any vehicle over 20 feet long at night here in Santa Cruz. So, continuing with the story, enforcement will hit in San Francisco before there's anywhere legal to go. Translation, 1,400 people will be told to move along with no place to move to. And of course, Santa Cruz County is also, at least it was considering in August, a proposal to give sheriffs and other enforcement agencies more power to go after vehicles that they claim are abandoned. That is to say, if somebody isn't in them at the time, and then to haul them away or even to dismantle them and haul them away. And that is something we fought successfully in August, at least delayed, some of us. But it isn't clear what the status of that proposal is at this point. And I'll try to give you an update on it as soon as I get one. Meanwhile, back in San Francisco and this article, Mayor Daniel Lurie, Mayor of San Francisco, and other politicians love to pair compassion with accountability, as if repeating both words make them compatible. But here's the truth. You can't claim compassion while voting to make survival illegal. That's not accountability. It's displacement with better PR. It's that, if that's compassion, it's the kind you measure with a tow truck. Mayor Lurie secured $13 million over two fiscal years in the city budget for rapid rehousing subsidies, a vehicle buyback program, and outreach and enforcement resources. At least that's what the city says on its website. As yet, I've received no such offer, but $13 million spread across 1,400 vehicle dwellers works out to about $9,000 per person, maybe 3 months of rent in San Francisco. Then what? It's not a plan. It's a countdown clock to homelessness. The most common myth about RV residents is that we're freeloaders. In reality, most of us work, pay taxes, and keep our vehicles running. I drive for Uber when I'm not studying, clearing about $22 an hour, roughly $45,000 a year. That's below the bar for San Francisco rent, but not below the bar for human dignity. Perhaps the biggest complaint I hear about RV encampments is that they're dirty. Now, that's certainly true, but it's also fixable. Seattle opened legal dump stations, and the problem disappeared. A safe parking site with water, power, and waste disposal costs a fraction of building new housing. I'm not aware that Santa Cruz has opened any more legal dump stations, although that could be take a significant burden off of RV people, people who are using their vehicles as housing. Cities like Santa Barbara and San Diego have proven it works. Meanwhile, the cheapest private RV spot in the Bay Area runs $1,800 a month plus utilities for a gravel pad with no amenities. That's not affordable housing. That's extortion. Safe parking programs have worked for years in other California cities. Santa Barbara has run one since 2004, although, as I understand it, this is my comment from talking to people down there, an inadequate one. San Diego has hundreds of spaces. They buy people time without forcing them into chaos. That's the point, to stop criminalizing survival and give people utilities, security, and a path to housing. And no, safe parking programs shouldn't come with arbitrary time limits. People should be allowed to stay until they can move into permanent housing. Anything else just resets the cycle of displacement. Treat RV living as part of the housing strategy, not the end game, but a step away from the street. Until San Francisco can house everyone, taking away the only stability people have isn't a policy. It's cruelty, dressed up as governance. And that's an open forum story by Mike Little. San Francisco RV parking ban will force more people into the streets in the September 2nd, 2025 Chronicle. And if that wasn't heartening enough for you, here's another story, also from the San Francisco Chronicle, though you might not be able to find this online, and I often leave online net addresses for folks who get the Huff email, in case you want to try to follow that. Send me an email. If you don't get the Huff email, but you want to, send me an email. I'm Robert Norse at rnorse, R-N-O-R-S-E, 3, the number 3, at hotmail.com, and I will put you on the Huff email list if you're not there already. But I'm trying to give stories that people can access without getting to colliding with a paywall, which often happens, particularly with the Chronicle, sadly enough. Even though I've been a Chronicle subscriber, I still can't get past their paywall, so go figure. Anyway, here's another story from the Chronicle. SF clears encampment under highway. by Annie Wallenstein, and I think that's Weinstein, actually, and Sophia Bolyag. Encampments along the network of highway exits along Cesar Chavez Street in San Francisco were cleared in recent days in what state officials called the latest iteration of Governor Gavin Newsom's plan to, quote, tackle homelessness. Actually, it isn't in quotes in the story, but it's actually presented with a straight face, making more people, in essence, homeless and tentless and giving them no place to go, but claiming you're tackling homelessness. For years, encampments have formed in small passageways or inlets along the noisy tangle of freeway arteries connecting Cesar Chavez Street, Potrero Avenue, and Bayshore Boulevard, often referred to as the hairball. Caltrans and California Highway Patrol crews worked throughout the day Tuesday, that's about a week or two ago, to clear debris left over from the encampments, whose residents were given 72-hour notice on Friday to clear out their belongings and work with local agencies to receive support. Always a nice fig leaf when you're clearing away the homeless encampments. On Tuesday morning, little remained of the former encampments clustered around the vast exit network. Some people could be seen lugging belongings in shopping carts along the narrow underpass walkways. They appeared to be looking for new places to go as Caltrans workers began adding boulders and other deterrents to the former encampment sites that state officials said were key components of making sure the efforts would last. And of course, in Santa Cruz, what they do is they put up fences all around areas where previously people have camped in little communities. State officials said the effort in San Francisco was the first official clearing launched under Newsom's State Action for Facilitation on Encampments Task Force. Had a fancy lane for a name for mowing away people, which prioritizes encampments on state's right-of-way in California and California's 10 largest cities. The first thing you see when you get to San Francisco should be representative of the clean streets we have across the city, said San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie in a statement. I guess clean streets are one thing and clean conscience is another thing. Lurie continues, under my administration, city government will no longer tolerate the conditions we're seeing on our off-ramps and off-ramps and on-ramps. And now we have the tools to fix it. That is to say, the way of demolishing the encampments and forcing people to flee and hide somewhere else. The cleanup in San Francisco will precede similar clearings in other 9 largest cities, Los Angeles, Oakland, San Jose, San Diego, Sacramento, Long Beach, Anaheim, Bakersfield, and Fresno. That's Governor Newsom has authorized hundreds of millions of dollars in state funding for encampment clearing, in addition to steering more state funding toward treatment and housing for people living on the streets. So you got to treat them, and someday, somewhere, somehow, there'll be housing, maybe. In the meantime, hide them, or scare them away, or lock them up somewhere. The sweep on Tuesday coincides with a push by the federal government to clear homeless encampments across the country, the story continues. President Donald Trump, I like to call him our little Führer, issued an executive order in July declaring his intent to clear American cities of encampments by forcing homeless people to move. That sounds kind of like Governor Newsom, don't you think? Oh, no, wait, he's a Democrat. He would never do that. The deployment of troops to Washington, D.C. has also included an aggressive effort to push homeless people out of the city. At the same time, his administration has slashed funding for homeless services. Newsom, who has participated in multiple homeless cleanups himself, has become incensed by judges who blocked his administration from clearing encampments near Bay Area freeways. In an interview with the Chronicle in 2023, he called an order that blocked sweeps in San Francisco preposterous and inhumane. In 2023, he sided with conservative groups in filing an amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to allow state and local governments to crack down on people camping in parks, sidewalks, and near roads. After the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, Newsom issued an executive order urging local governments to identify and clean up dangerous encampments. And I don't think it specifies dangerous, actually. Supreme Court decision, that was Grants Pass versus Jackson, allows the city to make its own rules to clean up encampments, whether dangerous or not. Standing near the remains of one of the cleared underpass encampments, California Transportation Secretary Tokes Amashokan said the location was a top priority for city and state officials because of the dangers associated with camping so close to freeway traffic. And of course, they did provide alternate places for these people to go. If they did, they didn't tell us about it. "We're doing this work in what we call the California way," said Amashokan, "to make sure that we're doing this with concern and dignity for the people who are on our right of way." Or at least using the right kind of language, I guess. Jay Waringa, Deputy Secretary of Communications for the state's Business, Consumer Services, and Housing Agency, said that of the 18 people identified within the multiple Cesar Chavez underpass encampments, 12 spoke with service providers. Well, whoopee-doo. And 5 were already in shelters, for the limited time you're allowed to be in a shelter, I guess. Of the 7 who were offered shelter, only 1 person accepted. I wonder why that would be. And was transported to a service location, he said. It was not clear what happened to the remaining 6 people who were living under the freeway. Caltrans officials said people impacted in the encampment clearing would be able to store some of their items in a facility for up to 90 days, and that signs with information on how to retrieve their belongings were posted in areas where the sweeps took place. And there are similar signs posted in Santa Cruz, but when you go to post your stuff, you somehow find it can't be found. At least that's what I noted last year when 6 or 7 of us, 3 or 4 or 5 of us actually, went to pick up material that had been bagged and tagged and hefted away by city employees and deposited with the police. By mid-morning Tuesday, at least a dozen Caltrans workers were still working to clear debris, that's the remains of the homeless encampments after the Caltrans and the California Highway Patrol are finished with them, and place more boulders in patches of the underpass that had become encampment zones. The boulders would supplement ones already placed nearby to deter camping, officials said. Some of the boulders were originally placed under the freeway maze in 2017 in the hope of deterring homeless camps after officials cleared a troublesome or trouble-prone camp. Back then, unhoused residents who had been camping in the area told the Chronicle they would simply move their tents a few feet away from the boulders and put their sleeping bags between them. As San Francisco clears encampment under a highway by Annie Weinstein and Sophia Bolag in the September 18th San Francisco Chronicle. So now it's about time for a musical interlude. This is a song by Jesse Wells called Charlie. I presume it's about Charlie Kirk. Here's what the lyrics are, since they may be a little hard to hear. "For all the bile, the bold talk, the venom, the hate and the lies, no one should be killed, no blood should be spilled. Charlie shouldn't have died. Well, you can't hate the gun and love the gun that shot your rival. You can't be kind and wish pain upon a child. Everybody's got to say what they're needing to say as soon as they're needing to say it. The freedom to speak, to be a freak, and the freedom to say you hate it and have a big old conversation. I heard laughing, I heard glee, but it could have been you, it could have been me. And out in the bloodshed everyone loses. There's unforgettable scars. Out in the bloodshed, permanent bruises. shapes up who you are. Children left to wander America's aimless, with a firebrand of resent, wondering who it is took my daddy, with a destiny of revenge. Out in the bloodshed, the cycle begins, and everyone dies. Spin the wheel. If you don't get killed, you wind up dead inside. I heard laughing. I heard glee. But it could have been you. It could have been me.
For all the bile, the bold talk, the venom, the hate and the lies, no one should get killed, no blood should be spilled. Charlie shouldn't have died. Well, you can't hate the gun and love the gun that shot your rival. You can't be kind and wish hate upon a child. Everybody's gotta say what they're needing to say. As soon as they're needing to say it, the freedom to speak, to be a freak, and the freedom to say you hate it, and have a big old conversation. I heard laughing, I heard glee, but it could have been you, it could have been me. Bloodshed, everyone loses. There's unforgettable scars out in the bloodshed, permanent bruises. Shapes up who you are. Children let the wonder of America aimless with the firebrand of resent. Wondering who it is took my daddy with the destiny of revenge. Out in the bloodshed, the cycle begins. And everyone dies, you spin the wheel. If you don't get killed, you'll wind up dead inside. I heard laughing, I heard glee, but it could have been you, it could have been me.
So I wasn't able to reach Wes White, my sort of activist contact in Salinas tonight. Probably he's off videotaping somewhere or some event. He did do a thing that he posted on his YouTube channel, John Doe 13K, called Interfaith and Community Leaders Call for U.S.-Palestine Policy Changes in Monterey and Salinas. It's about the Gaza genocide and the murder and the ethnic cleansing that's being funded with U.S. bombs and U.S. dollars over there. And there was, of course, their standard Saturday protests that were happening. I went to that and banged a few pots myself at the corner of Ocean and Water Streets and distributed a little literature and did a tiny bit of interviewing. But this video does give a really nice description, and I think an educational one, of that sort of counters the mainstream media's Jewish supremacist initiative. Again, there's nothing wrong with, I'm no fan of any particular religion, whether it's Judaism or Islam or Buddhism or Christianity, you name it. For me, for my money, they're all mythologies. But, you know, folks certainly should have the right to believe what they wish, as long as they don't try to impose it on the rest of us, and as long as they don't seek to displace and murder indigenous peoples, which is what, of course, Israel is doing with the Palestinians, in my view. So here's something about this issue that Wes White was able to record. You can find it and see the speakers speaking as well as hear them, but I'm going to play you at least, I'm not sure how much of it, but a bit of the Interfaith and Community Leaders at this event in Monterey and Salinas. You can find ongoing events happening in that area in South, the county directly to the south of ours, by going to indybay.org, indybay.org, and look on the calendar there, and you'll see different events coming up. And you'll see an event there for Tuesday, day after tomorrow, if you're listening to this on Sunday the 4th. It's going to be October 7th, actually Sunday the 5th, sorry. That's going to be from 3 to 6. It's being thrown by the Students for Justice in Palestine, Santa Cruz. They'll begin at 3 o'clock at the base of the UCSC campus. Then they will march from that base on High Street down to Mission Plaza, which is about a block or two from the freeway at the end of, before where Mission Street hits the freeway. And they invite you to join Students for Justice in Palestine to honor the martyrs of the ongoing genocide perpetrated by Israel and by the United States. And it's bombs and it's money and it's indifference. In Palestine and march in solidarity with the steadfastness of the Gazans. Come out and support as this October 7th marks 2 years since the genocidal violence accelerated within the decades-long oppression of the Palestinian people. Speeches and teach-ins will take place at Mission Park following a march from the basic campus, as mentioned before. The popular education will highlight the current conditions and starvation in Gaza. Israel's blocking the food as the Palestinian people continue to struggle for their survival. And there'll be a march again going to from campus, 3 o'clock, to Mission Park. Mission Park will then have speeches and teach-in at 4:15, and then open mic starting at 5:15 and 6 p.m. You can speak your own thoughts there on the issue. And this thing is important to me, not only because it's, our money is going for it, and it's a murderous form of genocide that coarsens all of us, steals our consciences every time we look away, and we damn well look away a lot, I'm afraid, at least I do. So, it's worth educating yourself about and doing what you can about, in spite of all the talk about a ceasefire. There's been multiple ceasefires violated by Israel in the last 2 years, and in the last, 70 years, there's been massive seizure of land by the Israeli regime, Jewish supremacist regime, giving a bad name to both Judaism and Zionism, I might say. I wanted to say one thing, that there was this, why does this a particular interest to me as well? Because, I link it up with homeless civil rights struggles in the United States. Homeless people are, in a way, our own Palestinians. They are people who are simply trying to survive, and they are treated as less than human in the way that the Israeli government and this murderous police force, the IDF, it's not really a military, even though they use military weapons and then planes and bomb the Palestinians, they aren't really fighting an army. They're fighting a whole population and labeling them terrorists. So let's hear about at least what's said at this most recent event. And again, this is the Interfaith and Community Leaders calling for U.S.-Palestine policy changes in Monterey and Salinas. It was a press conference outside of the Jimmy Panetta's office. He's the local misrepresentative. And here it is.
Afternoon. Thank you for being here. Just wanted to open up. My name is Carlos Ocampo. I am one of the members of the Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective. Thank you. You know, today we're here for a variety of different reasons. One being most pressing, But I think the one that is overall that I think we can all agree with and our foundation is standing in solidarity with the people of Palestine as they endure an ongoing genocide, famine, and not just in genocide and famine, but also the occupation of their land. So that is their foundation. Just to give a little bit of context, this has been organized by some of our members from the Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective. The Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective, for those who aren't aware, has been organizing since October 2023. And this is almost 2 years, a sad and infuriating 2 years. And we've been working to put an end to the U.S. complicity and support that U.S. provides to the occupation of Palestinian land. Now, while we have organized in Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective protests, film screenings, BDS campaigns, political education projects, today we gather for a very specific purpose. And that purpose is to hold our elected Congressman Jimmy Panetta, also commonly known as Genocide Jimmy, accountable for his ongoing complicity in the genocide of the Palestinian people, and to call him into action and to provide him a safe, to provide him an arm into his humanity, into his own morality. Because we understand that today it is the morally and politically just thing to do to act in favor, in support of Palestinian liberation. So you're going to be hearing a variety of different speakers, different faith leaders, people from different faith communities, and just community members in general who have something to say to our elected representative, to their elected representative. So thank you again for being here today and giving your attention, and for everyone who's here present on the live stream. Today, first, we are going to listen to Nishwan Hamza, a member of the Islamic community in Monterey. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for the introduction. I appreciate it. I appreciate the invitation to come here, and I appreciate all of you for standing in solidarity for this purpose. We are witnessing a unique time in human history, a unique time in our country's history, where I never thought we would stoop down to this level, but here we are, and we are resisting. We are going to be resisting. I want you all to be able to listen to everyone's words as they're speaking today, but at the same time, I want you to have your eyes focus on all of these photos that we put around, because they put into context what we are talking about today. They are the reality of what we are talking about today. A little about me. I've been following the occupation myself for now over 40 years. And I have to tell you, from the onset, I was perplexed. I was perplexed as to why this conflict was so confusing to so many people. It seemed like a child could figure out easily the difference between oppressor and oppressed, between aggression and resistance to aggression, between human rights and occupation. And it took me several years to recognize that the truth was being purposely obscured by the greatest propaganda machine in human history. Over the years, I spent a lot of time clipping articles, quoting scholars, in the hopes that I might be able to show others in an attempt to separate truth from lies. I chronicled rebuttals to Israeli lies about failed so-called peace negotiations, their murderous rampages, and the denial of basic human rights. All in an attempt to show the difference between cause and effect of occupation. I have now thrown out the volumes of paperwork that I've had. I don't need them anymore, because today we no longer need any further evidence of the realities of the Zionist project. We don't need to rebut the lies and narratives that they have peddled to the world for over 75 years. Because in the last 2 years alone, they have laid bare their genocidal goals through their vile words coming from their own mouths, along with the slaughter and starvation committed by their own hands. from the words of the Zionist forefathers originally, who said, "The Jewish colonial project cannot be achieved without force, because no people give up their land without fighting for it." All the way to today's quote from their Minister of Finance, who says, "We are erasing the Palestinian state, first in practice, then officially, and the world is letting us do it." So the world has now witnessed the truth behind the Zionist lies, where every accusation is an admission, where every Zionist talking point is an attempt to pacify the world into accepting the Jewish nation as the victim. The people of the world have taken to the streets in ways that we have not seen, and back until the time where we invaded Iraq illegally. And we all remember those times when people were in the streets all over the world in every major city. And the world is yet again rising up to be on the right side of history and on the right side of human decency. Understand this. It is the youth who have set the tone for this event and for every event across the world. And let me reflect their tone by saying that they have woken up to these truths and they're angry. They're angry at the crimes committed in their names and with their tax dollars. They're angry for the many illegal wars that were sold to us as fighting for America, but in reality, they were fought for Israel. They are angry at the billions of dollars given to Israel while their own citizens suffer at home. They are angry at a foreign government that has bought off our congressmen. They are angry at allowing dual citizen politicians and corporate heads putting Israel first over America first. Our Jewish youth are probably the angriest of all. Why? Because they are angry at the false narratives that they have been indoctrinated with since childhood. And I sympathize with them, and I stand with them. When students were being shunned, doxxed, and brutalized by their own universities and police departments, it allowed them to begin to peel back the layers of what I call the Zionist onion of lies. They discovered how we as a nation have been and continue to be controlled by a foreign state. The youth's eyes have been opened and they will never be blinded again. Together, we have all awakened to understand that the Palestinian struggle is the spearhead to all of our other struggles. So why are we here? Why are all these people from varying faiths here today? They're here because they recognize that aside from the economic burden that funding a genocide has cost us, that aside from the social divisions between colleagues, friends, and family members that this has caused us, there is a moral reckoning that is also occurring. The Slovenian president recently made a public address in which she reflected not only her country's political stance, but also a moral one. Her words resonate with all of us, regardless of whatever our faith is. She says, "Our handling of Gaza reflects our understanding of humanity. It is through our dealings with Gaza that we reveal who we are. If you cannot confront the realities of Gaza, what does it say about you? If you cannot address Gaza, what legitimacy do we have to confront gross violations of human rights anywhere? Values and norms are values and norms everywhere for everyone and also for Gaza." And so it is that how our elected officials view Gaza is how they view the values of their own religion and how they view the values of national and international laws. They will either defend them or they will dismiss them. And it is up to us, the people, to then determine whether we wish to keep them in positions of power or to remove them. All of us, when we are marginalized, we question. We question humanity's moral compass. They ask the world, "Will you do the right thing? Will you stand with us?" Understand that if you are Native American and you're fighting environmental justice, or an African American fighting for economic justice, or an Asian American fighting for social justice, or even a white American, in all our shades of religious, economic, and educational statuses, all of us, when we are fighting injustice, are holding up that same moral compass. We are asking our leaders and our fellow citizens, do your words and actions respect our shared morality? Today, the world is asking and saying that Gaza is the moral compass of our time today. What they mean is this: when we witness the greatest crimes against humanity being committed against a helpless people, how do we react? And how do we tell, what does it tell us about who we are and if we truly believe in that moral compass we profess to follow? For those of you who are monotheists, and as such, you are the ones who believe in a day in which we will all be judged by our words and our actions, understand, Gaza is your trial run for that day. As a man living in paradise amongst all of you, I don't have firsthand experience to share with you with regards to the living horrors, the resilience and the bravery of what Palestine is and what they endure. So I'll share with you a story that Dr. Mohammed Mustafa shares. He is a Palestinian doctor who works in what's left of a bombed out hospital in Gaza. He spoke of the horrors he witnessed, seeing mothers and fathers coming in, holding the shredded bodies of their dead or dying children, pleading for help, or pregnant mothers coming in needing a cesarean, only to have their bellies cut open without anesthesia to try and save both their lives. He spoke of a young girl who was no more than 8 or 9, coming in holding her injured 2-year-old baby brother. Her whole family was murdered, yet she survived and managed to pull out her baby brother from under the rubble with her own hands. She walked barefoot several kilometers under night, under drone fire, while trying to kill them to try to save her baby brother. The lesson, and this story is repeated ad nauseum. If you listen to any of the online doctors and healthcare workers who have gone there from all over the world risking their lives, this is nothing but a daily occurrence. The lesson of Palestinian resistance while living and dying under the most brutal conditions is this: whatever the oppression and loss of rights, loss of economy, loss of free speech we face in our lives, from what we have witnessed in Gaza and the West Bank, we can now use the courage of the Palestinian resistance as our inspiration. If they can continue to fight oppression, occupation, and genocide, we most certainly have the moral obligation to fight our leaders to continue to allow this to happen. It is because of Gaza that we now understand that if we do not collectively resist our politicians from engaging funding genocide there, those politicians will come to know that we do not have the backbone or the moral standing to resist them from taking away democracy here. There are now hundreds of politicians, economists, military brass, and even right-wing podcast hosts openly acknowledging that American government is bought and paid for by the Israeli lobby. We then have to ask ourselves, what greater national security threat is there than having our politicians beholden to a foreign state? What could there be more than that? We the people are the ones responsible for making them understand that we elected them to stand for America first and not Israel first. So we as citizens of the 19th district, we have a representative. We're perplexed because we have a representative who by most measures responds to our community's needs, yet he is so seemingly blind to our cries about Palestine. What are we to make of a man who takes decisive action on agriculture, tourism, healthcare, and a host of other issues, yet not only ignores genocide, but has taken measures and positions to accelerate it? What are we to make of a man that is a member of the Catholic Church, yet does not take strong measures to stop his country from committing what his religion considers to be the gravest of sins? Remember, this is a genocide that would not be occurring without the U.S. blessing and U.S. funding. So it is our genocide. It is our genocide. What we have to ask ourselves is, are we okay with our elected officials working to put food on our table and money in our pockets, while also accepting to starve and bomb families abroad? This is not hyperbole, this is reality. When he voted to remove the United Nations Aid Agency from delivering food to 2.5 million people, that began the starvation. He then continued the starvation when he openly supported the barbaric Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that not only could not feed them, but murdered the starving people while they came to get a morsel of food. Despite seeing these horrors of Israelis' genocide, he has refused to sign on to a bill that many of his Democratic colleagues have already signed, that simply asks the U.S. government to abide by our national laws and stop sending bombs that go and kill and starve innocent people. He refuses to sign a bill that asks to simply let the United Nations back in to feed those that are starving in famine conditions right now. Understand that unless you stand up and say, not in my name, he is in effect adding your name and my name as complicit in genocide. There is a religious mandate for all of us. When we see oppression and injustice, we must first resist it with our hands, to rise up. If not our hands, then our words, to speak out. And if not our words, then resist with our hearts. But all of us living here in paradise have no excuse for not using both hands and our full-throated voices to resist those that stand in the way of injustice that we are feeling in our hearts. Thank you very much.
Next, we will hear from Elisa. She will be reading a statement from one of our community members, one of our Palestinian community members, Rula Alaidi. Thank you.
So I wanted to start with Rula's lawyer's statement, and then when I'm finished with her statement, I will talk about Rula's statement as well. I speak today not just as Dr. Rula Alaidi's attorney, but as her friend and as a witness to Israel's ongoing efforts to exterminate Dr. Alaidi's family in Gaza. In March 2024, we filed 20 humanitarian parole applications for Dr. Alaidi's brothers, spouses, and their children. Let me be very clear here of what the intentions of the American Humanitarian Parole Program is. HP is not a pathway to permanent residency. It is not a replacement for visas. It is a temporary guest pass to America, a lifeline for families like Dr. Alaidi's who are daily facing death. America has a long history of using parole to help these in the worst imaginable humanitarian crisis. In February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the United States immediately welcomed 650,000 Ukrainians fleeing Russia's invasion through one-year humanitarian parole. Similarly, our government has used parole to protect our Afghan allies and those fleeing violence in Cuba, Haiti, and Venezuela. So when Israel began its military assault in Gaza, and Palestinian Americans like Dr. Alaidi watched in horror as our tax dollars and weapons began slaughtering and eradicating their family lines. We rushed to file parole applications for family members of Palestinian Americans, including Rola's family. Each parole application cost us $450. Each application said in bold letters, urgent, requesting hasty processing. And then we waited. Over a year passed. Presidents changed. We begged at the doors of our elected leaders, including Representative Panetta, whose office was on notice of how urgently we needed intervention to push these applications through, to push for a positive decision. In the meantime, hundreds of thousands in Gaza continued to be killed and starved to death. In March of this year, Rola, along with many other Palestinian Americans, began receiving blanket rejection letters for their parole application. No explanation was given except that the U.S. government didn't deem the situation in Gaza urgent enough. The U.S. has blood on their hands. We are complicit in this genocide in every imaginable way. And one of those ways in which we failed Rola's family. Last week, Israel murdered Rola's sister-in-law, Reina. That in true cowardly fashion, the IOF shot this unarmed young mother in the back with a missile. She bled out alone for hours. She did not have to die. She could have been in the U.S. with her children. And Rola had the U.S. government granted a lifeline to this family, like they have in the past to vulnerable populations fleeing war. This is our legacy now, the ultimate unforgivable sin that we are all now unwilling parties to. The day Rolla's sister-in-law was killed, we both wept. We then wiped our tears, told ourselves we'd take a day and then we'd have to get back to work. Rolla still has family in Gaza. We have to do what we can to save them. We will be submitting Dr. Lady's family's applications. We also continue our demand for the U.S. government to end its wholesale support of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Everyone listening to this, I remind you and I urge you to not look away. Whether Dr. Lady's family should live is not a complicated matter, a foreign policy question. It is an easy moral one. We have a history and a legal mechanism through which we have helped families like Dr. Lady's. And again, I remind you that the United States has done the right thing in the past by creating a swift, dignified pathway for Ukrainians.
And now it's time for another musical break. This is another Jesse Wells tune called United Hell. That is actually the first tune that I ever played of his, first song, which was, well, I don't know how many months ago, around the time of the Luigi Mangione shooting of Brian Wilson, the United Health bureaucrat. I like the song, and I'm going to play it again. These are the lyrics, in case you forgot them or can't really pick them up. There's an office with a desk with a person in a chair, and you paid for it all, though you may be unaware. You're paying for the paper, you're paying for the phone, you paid their salary to deny what you're owed. There ain't no you in United Health. There ain't no me in the company. There ain't no us in the private trust. And there's hardly humans in humanity. The procedure that you need ain't the cost-effective route. And only 2% of people end up winning a dispute. So if you get sick, pray to God for help, because all your doctor's prayers go up through United Health. Way back in 77... Mr. Richard T. Burke started buying HMOs and putting federal grants to work. Now it's $50 million he made just last year. The Warren Buffett of health, the Jeff Bezos of fear. CEOs come and go, and one just went. The ingredients you got bake the cake you get. So if you get sick, cross your fingers for luck, because old Richard T. Burke ain't giving a fuck. Commoditize health, monopolize fraud. Here's the doctors we own and the research that we bought. They own loans and physicians, pharmacies and meds. They should start selling graves just to fuck you when you're dead. There ain't no you in United Health. There ain't no me in the company. There ain't no us in the private trust. There's hardly humans in humanity.
There's an office and a building and a person and a chair, and you paid for it all, though you may be unaware. You paid for the paper, you paid for the phone, you paid for everything they need to deny what you're owed. There ain't no you in United Health. There ain't no me in the company. There ain't no us in the private trust. There's hardly humans in humanity. Now the procedure that you need ain't the cost-effective route, and only 2% of people end up winning a dispute. So if you get sick, pray to God for help, cause your doctor's gotta pray through United Health. Way back in 77, Mr. Richard T. Burke started buying HMOs, putting federal grants to work, made $50 billion. Last year, the Warren Buffett of health, the Jeff Bezos of fear. Now CEOs come and go, and one just went. The ingredients you got, bake the cake you get. But if you get sick, cross your fingers for luck, cause old Richard T. Burke ain't giving a fuck. Commoditized health, monopolized fraud. Here's the doctors we own and the research we bought. They own the pharmacies and a lot of the meds. They should start buying graves to sell us when we're all dead. There ain't no you in United Health. There ain't no me in the company. There ain't no us in the private trust. There's hardly humans in humanity. There's hardly humans in humanity.
And now back to the Interfaith and Community Leaders press conference on U.S.-Palestine policy.
It is not a complicated matter, a foreign policy question. It is an easy moral one. We have a history and a legal mechanism through which we have helped families like Dr. Elady's. And again, I remind you that the United States has done the right thing in the past by creating a swift, dignified pathway for Ukrainians, Venezuelans, Haitians, Cubans, and Nicaraguans. Palestinians deserve the same humanity. Every day we delay action is another funeral, another child orphaned, another family erased. This is Rola's statement. I am writing to express my deep concern and disappointment regarding the handling of the Aleidi family's parole applications by USCIS. It is with a heavy heart that I must state that our applications were not given the serious consideration they deserved. Despite the extensive documentation, detailed evidence, and urgent humanitarian circumstances presented, USCIS failed to treat our submissions as concrete evidence of the life-threatening situation that my family faces. The denial notices we received did not offer any clear reason or justification for the rejection of all a lady's family's parole applications. This lack of transparency and clarity has left us confused and devastated. My attorney, Maria Cari, and I spent weeks, indeed months, gathering and organizing evidence to build a strong case, driven by the desperate need to save what remains of my family who continue to suffer under siege, starvation, and constant threat of bombing in Gaza. I poured all of my time, energy, and financial resources into these applications. What makes this even more painful is the absence of meaningful support from the office of my congressional representative, Jimmy Panetta. Since March 14th of 2024, when I received the notice of action from USCIS, I have been sending repeated emails and urgent requests for his office to intervene, expedite, or provide any form of concrete assistance. I made it clear that the situation was dire and required immediate action to save lives. Yet no substantial help was offered and no progress was made. Now, with every passing day, my relatives remain trapped, facing death by starvation or airstrike at any moment. The humanitarian crisis is worsening and the clock is ticking for my loved ones. I respectfully urge all concerned parties to reconsider the urgency of our case and take action before it is too late. My family's lives depend on it. And I will not be reading the names today, but I have counted about 62 family members of hers that have passed away. And also, I will be reading two family members of hers that were killed in August 2025, Saeed Alaidi and her sister-in-law, Rania Alaidi. And that'll be all for Rola. Thank you.
Thank you, Elisa. And I forgot to introduce Elisa as a member of the Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective. Next, we will have TJ, another member of the Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective, come join us. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is TJ, and I will be speaking today from my perspective as an atheist humanist, a resident of Carmel, a voter from District 19, and a friend of Rola and many other Palestinians, both in Gaza and the West Bank. Jimmy Panetta and I seemed to keep crossing paths. Our first intersection was attending the same school as his children, meaning his name was always buzzing around Carmel High School. Different events to volunteer for him came around. Family members and close friends would meet him at the county fair. I heard stories about his father after the first time I noticed his name was written on a street sign in Carmel Valley. Who was this man who was enough of a local celebrity to have an entire street named after him? And now I stand here because our paths have intersected once again, but this time it is not because of the excited chatter around a high school or a conversation with a parent about his, but because this man holds the future of one of my dearest friends in his hands. Rola Alaidi has been fighting to secure the safety of her family since October of 2023. She has lost over 100 family members, and only 2 weeks ago, she lost one more. Her name was Rania. It meant to gaze at, a striking appearance. I could go on and on about what an incredible person Rola is, but I feel the need to emphasize that it shouldn't matter to you what kind of a person she is. She is a human, we are all humans, and she and her family have been placed under the kind of conditions that if you even read about them in a book would keep you awake at night. Bombing after bombing, fire, bullets, starvation beyond imagination, blood and loss and death everywhere. I've become friends with her nephew, Salem, who is an incredible photographer and writer. And when the invasion of Gaza began, he was 16 years old. He is now 18, the remaining precious years of his childhood swept away by this unending bloodbath. His sister, Amna, has graduated from university, continuing her studies in the midst of a brutal erasure of her home. She is 20 years old, the same age as me, as well as one of Jimmy Panetta's daughters. Panetta has the power to make a difference in whether or not the Alaidi family lives or dies. All it would take is the swift motion of a pen across a paper, and instantly she has the support of a member of Congress, something she can lean on in her battle against the government's purposeful disregard for the humanitarian urgency unfolding in Gaza. But Panetta has chosen to delay, to look the other way, to vote against the end of the slaughter, to use his position of power to accept nearly $500,000 from the representatives of a genocidal regime. He has sold his soul and those and the lives of 2.2 million people for $500,000, not even enough money to buy a house in the very neighborhood he lives in. My hope for today is that if Jimmy Panetta can see that Rola and her family are not alone, that there are many of us from all across District 19, including his own community, he will finally listen. This is a demand from his constituents that he helps the people of Gaza and the Alaidi family finally have a moment of peace. Thank you.
Next, we'll be welcoming up Dr. Sarah Salazar-Hughes, CSUMB Professor, Scholar of Settler Colonialism in Palestine.
Thanks, y'all, for having me. Salam alaikum. In my brief remarks today, I want to challenge two ideas. First, the absurd assertion that what we're witnessing in Gaza is a war between Israel and Hamas, and not a genocide. And second, that this is a conflict with no solution. Israeli officials and the US government want us to understand the genocide in Gaza as a war between two equal adversaries. A war started by Hamas on October 7th, 2023. Calling this a war implies that the violence started on October 7th, which is absurd. Calling this a war implies that before October 7th, there was peace. But Palestinians haven't had peace for nearly 100 years. Living under colonialism, under occupation, means living everyday war. There is no peace, only ongoing displacement, disruption, arrest, and death. My area of expertise is Israeli settlers. I've worked with a lot of Palestinians, but I don't study Palestine. I study Israelis. I try to understand them in order to find the cracks that we might exploit. Leanne Simpson tells us that societies built on conquest cannot be sustained, and Zionism is cracking. Israelis didn't have peace either before October 7th, though maybe they think they're experiencing it as a disruption of theirs. Colonial violence always rebounds onto the colonizers. Israelis know distraction, avoidance, disavowal, denial, all the ways that they pretend like their lives are not built on death and destruction. And a lot of work goes into pretending that there is peace for anyone in Palestine and Israel. But really, like all settlers, Israelis feel a constant, deep anxiety. They feel unsettled. They are usurpers. They are illegitimate, privileged persons. who are constantly trying to convince themselves and the rest of us that they are legitimate. All Palestinians have been living through Israeli settler colonization. In Gaza and the West Bank, in 1948, Israel, in refugee camps, and in the diaspora. All Palestinians share an experience of displacement, dispossession, and erasure. In Gaza, this is accomplished through all-out destruction long before October 7. Gaza is home to about 2.3 million Palestinians, or it was before tens of thousands were killed and many more displaced, and many starving as we speak. And Israeli officials are clear that they intend to render Gaza unlivable. They are very open about their genocidal intent. A majority of Palestinians in Gaza are refugees or descendants of refugees from 1948. Gaza has been under an Israeli military occupation since 1967, a blockade for over 30 years, and a complete aerial land and sea siege for at least the past 16 years. That means that since half of Gaza's 2.3 million people are under 16 years of age, they've lived their entire lives in conditions of war. They have never known peace. They have never known safety. They have never known freedom. Since 2005, there have been at least five so-called Gaza wars, which Israeli leaders euphemistically refer to as mowing the lawn. Periodically mowing down Palestinian resistance to the ongoing occupation and settler colonization of Palestine. They mow the lawn whether Hamas takes violent action or whether Palestinians protest peacefully. There is no way that Palestinians have fought for their liberation that has not been met with death. There is nothing that they haven't tried. This is the context in which we have to understand the attack on October 7th. And this is the context in which the current genocide should be seen, as a continuation and amplification of an enduring Zionist project of cleansing Palestine of Palestinians. But even in the face of ongoing Israeli settler colonialism, I am also going to assert that this is not an unsolvable situation. Acting like it's too complicated and there's nothing that can be done about it is just another way to do nothing about it. We do not have to accept this reality. Decolonization is possible. It's not just possible, it's essential for both the liberation of Palestinians and for the liberation of Israeli Jews. There is no military solution. Israel cannot wipe out armed resistance to occupation through force. There is no world in which the Israeli colonization of Palestine continues, but no violence rebounds onto Israelis. There is no two-state solution. Insisting on a two-state solution is also a delay tactic. In my mind, and in the mind of my Palestinian friends in the West Bank, the only way forward is one binational state where both Palestinians and Israelis are full and equal citizens, equally free. Decolonizing settler colonialism means dismantling settler white supremacy and replacing it with a completely different regime, something that the Israeli state would rather not do. The assertion that Palestinian liberation inherently means Jewish-Israeli extermination is an assertion that's grounded in a settler colonial mindset. Settlers believe in a winner-take-all, zero-sum game. Colonialism asserts that for one people to be free, another must be unfree. They believe that freedom is a scarce resource and not everyone can have it. It's framed this way to prevent us from imagining beyond what is, to prevent us from dreaming our way out. But if we're really paying attention, we know that none of us are free until we are all free. Free Palestine.
Next, we will be welcoming Elaine, the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church, up to give some comments. Thank you.
So, I'm Reverend Elaine Gehrman, co-minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Monterey Peninsula. In March of 2017, I traveled to the West Bank with a group of ministers and saw firsthand, with my own eyes, the Israeli apartheid system in action. The heavily armed military checkpoints, the enormous separation wall with its armed guard towers, the illegal settlements being constructed on bulldozed villages, the extreme life-threatening rationing of water and medical care for Palestinians. In June of 2024, at our annual Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, our denomination passed an action of immediate witness entitled Solidarity with Palestinians. It begins, "Our Unitarian Universalist faith draws on the moral imperative of radical love, and despite all odds, calls us to uphold a world where liberation is real and we all thrive. Our faith community has long recognized the horrors of violent anti-Semitism against generations of Jewish people, and we reaffirm our commitment to their safety. Our support for Jewish well-being was never meant to undermine the rights and lands of Palestinian people. We seek a world where our Palestinian and Jewish kin are safe. We believe that until Palestinians are free, none of us is free. Israel has subjected Gaza to indiscriminate bombings with U.S.-made weapons, resulting in tens and thousands of civilian casualties, including journalists, aid workers delivering food and medical supplies, healthcare workers, and thousands of children. Israel has blocked necessary aid delivery, depriving Palestinians of food, water, medicine. The targeted and widespread destruction of medical, cultural, agricultural, educational, and religious sites constitutes ethnic cleansing." Our declaration continues. "We call for the liberation of Palestine and an end to the apartheid, declare our moral outrage and shared horror at Israel's massacre, mass incarceration, torture, destruction of the land and poisoning soil for future generations, and decimation of systems of care that support life in the region. We call for an immediate permanent ceasefire, massive humanitarian aid, the release of all captives, and an end to genocide around the world. We support boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and corporate enablers, and end U.S. military aid to Israel until it ceases its policies and practices of apartheid, military occupation, settler colonialism, and genocide. We strive to protect the freedom and safety of solidarity activists by supporting protests and opposing legislation and policies that restrict our First Amendment rights." Our denomination passed this declaration in June of 2024. Now, after almost 2 years of genocide, the Israeli government's policy of starvation as a weapon of war has reached new levels. Famine has been declared in Gaza. Palestinians, including children and babies, are dying from hunger, as the pictures show, while more are shot and killed by the Israeli military as they try to receive meager amounts of aid. The United States is complicit. We are supplying the arms that are maiming and murdering civilians, including children, journalists, entire families. The bombs and bulldozers that are destroying houses and villages and entire communities. Our government is helping support the blockades, preventing food and other life-saving supplies to reach the thousands of displaced victims. Since October 2023, the U.S. has given more than $30 billion in taxpayer-funded weapons to Israel to enable its atrocities. Their blood is on our hands, and we have the power to stop this. I am weeping and raging at this horrific destruction, this loss of so many precious lives. I am praying for peace and pleading with my elected representatives to do all in their power to stop these illegal criminal actions of the Israeli government and to stop funding these atrocities. And I implore our representatives to support the H.R. 3565, the Block the Bombs Act. We can put an end to this illegal, immoral destruction. As people of faith, we are praying for it to end, and as people of conscience, we are speaking up and showing up and calling on our representatives and our fellow citizens to act to stop this now. Thank you.
And here's another cheery tune by Jesse Wells called Starve Away, kind of the current Trump policy in Gaza, I guess. I'll give you the lyrics, and then you get to hear the song. God sanctioned death, the kind that I like best. I like a good just war. It's what guns are for. I like a good crusade. It brightens my day. Starve away. Annihilate with cosmic vindication. Bring us John Wayne justice for the chosen nation. Lord, scatter their bones in your sweetness. Speed forth the second coming of the great white Jesus. This is my prayer unto you, O Lord. I hope it comes true. Rain down your blessings from heaven on me and starve the women and the children of my enemy. Warranted pain and holy retribution, couple things my God needs to make a solution. May their children wander aimless in desolated streets with no memory of a mother, no father indeed. Raised up by war, their fist in a clench, breed the next generation of bombs in a ditch. This is my prayer unto you, O Lord, I hope it comes true. Rain down your blessings from heaven on my and starve the women and children of my enemy. My congressman's got a heavy load on his back. It's full of money and blood, straight out of a pack. He's in the tall cotton, but he hasn't forgotten to starve away. My governor buys his rarely bonds with the taxes of the poor down in Arkansas. She says, lucky me, I'm Huckabee, starve away. This is my prayer unto you, O Lord, I hope it comes true. Rain down your blessings from heaven on my, and starve the women and the children of my enemy.
God sanctioned death, it's the kind that I like best. I like a good just war, it's what guns are for. I like a good crusade, it brightens my day. Starve away, annihilate with holy vindication. Bring us John Wayne justice for the chosen nation. Lord, scatter their bones in your sweetness. Speed forth the second coming of the great white Jesus. It's my prayer unto you, oh Lord, I hope it comes true. Rain down your blessings from heaven on me. Starve the women and the children of my enemies. All right. Warranted pain and cosmic retribution. Couple things my God needs to make the solution. May their children wander aimless in desolated streets with no memory of a mother, no father indeed. Raised up by war, their fist in a clench, breed the next generation of bombs in a ditch. It's my prayer unto you, oh Lord, I hope it comes true. Rain down your blessings from heaven on me and starve the women and the children of my enemies. All right. My congressman got a heavy load on his back. It's full of money and blood, straight out of a pack. And he's in the tall cotton, but he ain't forgotten to starve away. And my governor buys Israeli bonds with the taxes of the poor down in Arkansas. She says, lucky me, I'm a Huckabee, starve away. My prayer unto you, oh Lord, I hope it comes true. Rain down your blessings from heaven on me. Starve the women and the children of my enemies. Right.
Next, we welcome up Carl, who is a chapter member of Jewish Voice for Peace in the South Bay chapter.
In October of last year, Israel remotely exploded a very large number of bombs in pagers, killing or injuring over 1,000 people, not only Hezbollah members, but also bystanders. the former congressman from this area and former head of the CIA, Leon Panetta, immediately labeled this an act of terrorism by Israel. His son, Jimmy Panetta, who owes his position to his father's name recognition, had nothing to say. Shortly after, Netanyahu ghoulishly gifted a golden pager to Donald Trump in the White House. Again, no response from Jimmy Panetta. So what has Jimmy Panetta been willing to say about Palestine and Israel? In 2024, he co-signed a congressional letter that, quote, expresses our disgust, unquote, with South Africa's filing of a, quote, grossly unfounded case against Israel at the International Criminal Court of Justice, unquote. He then voted with Republicans to sanction the International Criminal Court for Netanyahu's arrest warrant for war crimes. And again, he voted with Republicans to disallow the State Department from citing Gaza Health Ministry statistics, casualty statistics, including death counts that medical authorities say are grossly undercounted. He was one of only 15 Democrats to support H.R. 9495, the kill nonprofit bill that targets Palestinian protesters and their free speech. That was in December of last year. He protested with 25 Democrats when Biden suspended a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs in May of last year. He has voted numerous times to cut funding for UNRWA, the UN agency set up to provide humanitarian aid to Palestinians, now leaving them at the mercy of the U.S.-Israeli fake agency that is overseeing the slaughter of about 1,000 Gazans seeking emergency food rations. But what should or could our congressmen be supporting now? Well, H.R. 3565, that would block transfer of the worst offensive weapons to Israel. H.R. 2411, that would restore U.S. funding to UNRWA. That's the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Humanitarian Aid to Palestinians. H.R. 3045, that would sanction West Bank settlers responsible for violence directed against Palestinians. All three of these are supported by our area Congressman Ro Khanna and several other congresspeople, but not by Panetta. Why won't Panetta support these bills? Well, in each of his five elections to Congress, his largest funders have been consistent donations of approximately $250,000 by AIPAC, pro-Israel AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and an approximately equal amount from the arms industry. They bought Panetta and they own him. We need a genuinely anti-militarist congressperson, one who actively opposes the Israeli genocide that is occurring in the sight of the world every day.
We next welcome up Alec, a member of the Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here. Really appreciate your time. I just want to say really quickly that Jimmy Panetta's staff, when you're going to see this eventually, that you're not absolved from this. When Jimmy Panetta signs all these bills and this legislation, it's your name that's on them too. That's all I have to say about that. Afterwards, there's one more speaker. Elliot will finish us eloquently, I'm sure. And after that, if anyone would like to go into Jimmy Panetta's office, that is the plan. I do have a list of names of child victims that I would like to hand over to them. It's a printed list. You're welcome to take a sheet of the paper if you'd like to put one in with it. They cannot deny you access. If you have something to submit to Jimmy Panetta, they have to give you the time to submit it, and they have to give you the time to give your statement and give your information. So afterwards, maybe 5-10 minutes after, give me a chance to load everything up. If you want to come on down, let's do it. Thank you.
And our last speaker of the day will be Elliot, retired director of social services from Monterey County.
Good good afternoon, everyone. My name is Elliot Robinson, and in so many ways, I truly wish I didn't feel duty-bound to be here today, and I could continue to live out my years in humble privacy. You see, for 17 years, I was the Director of Social Services for Monterey County. I had many responsibilities, welfare assistance, employment services, nutrition assistance, Medi-Cal eligibility, home care, adult protective services, and child protective services. At its core, my job was working to protect and provide for our community's most vulnerable children, families, and people living with disability and frailty. Towards the end of my career, in 2015, two children were murdered while my department had an open case investigating their caregiver. It was a terrible tragedy that brought lots of soul searching on how we can all, as individuals, as a child welfare agency, and as a community, do more to prevent the murder and abuse of children. Thankfully, the perpetrators were tried and are serving their sentences as judged in a court of law. But the weight of that tragedy troubled me deeper than I knew it could. I continued in my role for almost 3 years after those traumatic events in order to stabilize the organization and to be sure that the caring women and men who work in social services were not embroiled in crisis and could continue delivering the best possible help for those in need, particularly children. And when that was achieved, I passed the torch to new leadership and I went off to grieve in my own way in the mountains and deserts of the western U.S. and along our Pacific coastline. But I can't help follow the news. And only the blind don't see what Israel is doing in Gaza through the same lens we view Bosnia, Rwanda, South Africa, Cambodia, and Germany. And while war is never good, but through all the brutality of warfare, there's a bottom line that no military should stoop so low as. That is child abuse, child neglect, child torture, and child murder. These are the lowest of all war crimes. And now here today, I see the government I worked so hard for and swore allegiance to for so many years, using my tax dollars to fund, arm, support, and protect Israel's genocidal bloodbath in Gaza. Since October 2023, almost 20,000 children have been murdered by Israel in full partnership with two American administrations, Trump's and Biden's. There were bipartisan standing ovations in Congress for a charged war criminal. Now, to the utter horror of the world around us, the U.S., which once offered itself as a beacon of human values, has taken up this cause of greed, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. And here in Monterey County, my former colleague from the District Attorney's Office and my community's current representative in Congress, Representative Panetta, voted to arm Israel. He voted to exempt Israel from international law and sanction the International Criminal Court for charging Israeli officials for their genocidal actions. He voted to demonize people who take a stand for humanity. And along the way, he accepted more than $500,000 in campaign donations from the American Israeli Political Action Committee. This is unconscionable. It is with prayers deep in my heart that I dream Representative Panetta reflects on how he voted, changes course, and stands up against child murder and ethnic cleansing. Or that someone else who can takes his seat. Let's all be active. Thank you for being here. Stand up for justice. Stand up for Palestine.
Again, thank you all for being here. We appreciate you all coming out. We all know you have a lot to do. We all have a lot to do, a lot of work to do. Today we bore witness to pain. We bore witness to our community heartbroken. And we bore witness to something that I think a lot of us think is quite useful, which is rage and anger. I hope that we can see ourselves as people who can create social change beyond this event, beyond the next event, and beyond the event afterwards. With that, we invite you to continue to organize, either in your own communities, in your own workplaces, in your own unions, or with Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective. We are here every Sunday. We've been holding down every Sunday since October 2023 at Windows on the Bay in Monterey. And I know I see some familiar faces here, but that is not all that we do. That is one piece of our political action. But please, we invite you to come join us. And if you do not decide not to come join us, then we invite you to look up and research about BDS campaigns. We invite you to put continued pressure on Panetta. We invite you to continue looking at anti-colonial struggles and decolonization. We invite you to meet with your other neighbors, with, again, your people in your workplace, to organize against something better than this, organize against the world that is better than the one that we have been given. Also, for those of you who are interested, you can follow us on Monterey Palestine Solidarity Collective, Monterey Palestine Solidarity, excuse me, on Instagram. So please do so. And then in addition, I would be remiss to not include some of the fundraising that our collective and some of our members are spearheading. We've heard from Rola Alaidi's family, and she has a constant, current struggle to raise funds for her family. We heard from some of the devastating news that has come out as of right now, her family members being murdered under constant siege. So we please implore you to ask one of us, come up to one of us after the protest, and we'd be happy to give you some literature on how you can support monetarily. We also have one of our other community members, TJ, who also has another fundraiser for the Alaidi family. And please learn how you can give and how we can get involved. Let today not be the only day that we are involved, but we see this as a constant struggle. And if I may, we'll close out with a chant. Can we do this? Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Thank you all for being here.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like they're not even going to talk to me. They told me to come outside to talk to me, and now they don't want to talk to me because they're just going to reject me from being able to visit my representative and have a recording of it. You guys are psycho. So what happened? You told me to come outside. Talk to me. What? Tell me the law. Tell me the law that I'm violating.
Right over here. Come on.
Tell me.
Step right over here.
I need a buddy. Somebody want to be my buddy, please?
Come here, sir. Right there.
Uh-huh.
You can record that.
Right. I'm not going in a courtroom.
This is a courthouse.
Yeah, and I'm not going in a courtroom. So what privacy am I violating? I'm only going in public areas.
This is a public area. That is... the courthouse.
If he gives you that while he passes through when he goes down to Panetta's office, wouldn't that be okay?
Sir, it is not. This is the courthouse.
Okay, the entire courthouse.
The entire courthouse. Okay. If once you are in Panetta's office, he allows you to record, that's up to him. Anytime.
So there is no such thing as a First Amendment as soon as you walk in this courthouse, is there?
Sir, that's up for...
So there, we are no longer in the United States once you walk in this courthouse. Because the Constitution means nothing. Our policy trumps the Constitution. That is some bullshit. This is all wrong. This is a total violation of the First Amendment.
Sir,
Completely. And for every judge to just back themselves up, because what do you got to hide anyway? Nothing, right? So then what's the problem? Why is it a problem? I'm going to see my representative. I'm not going into a courthouse to witness anybody's case without a prior media approval.
And if you're going to stay here, that door is automatic. You're going to break the... Thank you.
So what is my recourse? I'm not allowed to record anything inside this building?
You can have that turned off right now.
Uh-huh.
Once you're in Representative Panetta's office, if he allows you to record while you're in there, that's up to him.
Oh, that'd be great. All right, I'll turn it off and I'll go through the line. And I'll go downstairs and I'll turn it back on downstairs in Jimmy Panetta's office.
Inside
the door.
Once you cross that threshold.
Okay, great.
Turn it off, please.
To the protest, and he was a high school kid, and you know, I said, well, what are you worried, you're concerned about? And he says, yeah. I said, and he was a Chicano kid, I said, don't you, I said, friends, relatives? He said, not my problem. So that made my question right now is, how do you get people to
wake up,
see something?
I personally have needed to express my grief because it's just, it turns into anger. It turns into anger. Not just anger at the people doing it, but at the people who aren't awake. And that's, anger won't wake them up. It'll push them further away. And I get very angry. I've been angry at some of you. I get angry. And it's not a way to reach out. And I'm shifting, trying to shift to listening to what people's needs really are. What is it they're really concerned about? And to see if we can find a common essence, like a something that we all agree on. We all agree that children shouldn't die. I hope we all agree on that. So, this gathering of grief, reading the names of the children who have been killed in Gaza and been killed in Israel, is our statement that this must stop. And I want to thank the Jeff and Kathy and Anne and Margaret and Candy and Lewis for being here to make a statement. And I really believe that our Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren is going to step into saying we must stop these bombs to Israel. The bill is 3565, and it is expanding rapidly. It got 41 new congresspeople in the last 2 weeks, and I want the next one to be ours. I really do, because history will judge where people stood at this moment. at this very moment, in fact. So I think that we are doing Miss Lofgren a favor, and I am sure that she will step forward very soon. And instead of saying, why'd you take so long, I'm going to say, we're glad to have you. Whether...
But now it's time for another song by Jesse Wells called Domestic Error. And these are the lyrics. I didn't know the world was ending. I didn't know God's wrath was next. I never seen that many trolls down the rabbit hole until I went and logged into X. I asked the man what to do with my fingers, and the man didn't disappoint. He said, I'll tell you a story. Look at that minority and point, point, point. If peace ain't making a profit and love ain't making a buck, it takes two to tango. They need a bad guy. The man's going to make one up. Man tamed down the horse in that he saw no error, so he did the chickens and the pigs and the cows, and then he domesticated terror. And the snowball kept a-rolling, and we can't seem to get it to stop. They're trying law and order and securing the border, but our own field grows the crop. If I ever want to see that flag up high, I'm going to have to cut the pole in half. Because most of the time, most of our lives, it's been flying down at half-mast. Whoa, hotels, casinos, and spaceships, Teslas and tunnels are fine. Folks get too close to that big White House and they lose their goddamn minds. Then the Navy SEAL came to me. He said, boy, I'm going to tell you the news. I said, aren't you CIA? He said, I used to. I used to, but I still do, too. And we chewed our creatine gummies. And I wondered if he was lying. I said, well, what do you know about Vegas? He said, what do you know about dying? He said, it's going to be a bloody 25. He said, there's going to be some loss of life. He gave me a one-time code for 10% off, Blue Chews and collagen peptides. Whoa, hotels, casinos, and spaceships, Teslas and tunnels are fine. Folks get too close to that big White House, they lose their goddamn minds. Then a man in a big white hat came. He said, buddy, I'm going to fix it. You're going to keep all your rights and sleep good at night. He was buttering up my biscuits. He said, life is like a box of chocolates, but you should really eat only meat. I said, I have my doubts, but the man had gout, and that was more than I could say for me. He sent me a PDF, said check the box down here. There was a user agreement, but I didn't read it, and now he's listening through my ears. Hotels, casinos, and spaceships, Teslas and tunnels are fine. Folks get too close to the big White House, and they lose their goddamn minds.
I didn't know the world was ending. I didn't know God's wrath was next. I never seen that many trolls down a rabbit hole until I went and logged into X. I asked the man what to do with my fingers, and the man didn't disappoint. He said, I'll tell you a story, look at that minority and point, point, point. The peace ain't turning a profit, and love ain't making a buck. It takes two to tango, if they need a bad guy, the man's gonna make one up. The man tamed down the horse, and that he saw no error. So he did the chickens and pigs and the cows, and then he domesticated terror. And the snowball kept a-rolling, and we can't seem to get it to stop. They're trying law and order and securing the border, but our own field grows the crop. If I ever want to see that flag up high, I'm gonna have to cut the pole in half. Cause most of our lives, most of the time, it's been flying down at half mast. Hotels, casinos, and spaceships, Teslas and tunnels are fine. Folks get too close to that big White House and they lose their goddamn mind. And the Navy SEAL came to me. He said, boy, I'm gonna tell you the news. I said, aren't you CIA? He said, I used to, but I still do too. Then we chewed our creatine gummies, and I wondered if he was lying. I said, what do you know about Vegas? He said, said, what do you know about dying? He said, it's gonna be a bloody 25. He said, there's gonna be some loss of life. He gave me a one-time code for 10% off blue chews and collagen peptides. Then a man in a big white hat came. He said, buddy, I'm gonna fix it. You're gonna sleep good at night and keep all your rights. He was buttering up my biscuits. He said, life is like a box of chocolates, but you should really only eat meat. I said, I had my doubts, but the man had gout, and that was more than I could say for me. He sent me a PDF. I said, check the box down here. There was a user agreement, but I didn't read it. Now he's listening through my ears. Hotels, casinos, and spaceships. Teslas and tunnels are fine. Folks get too close to the big white house and they lose their goddamn mind.
And that pretty much winds it up for the contemporary edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Why don't I conclude with Caitlin Johnston? Her latest is Israel Droned Flotilla Activists and Then Abused Greta Thunberg. Johnston is a pro-Palestinian speaker and writer, and what she is writing is read by her partner Tim Foley. There's a prescript that says, who would have imagined 5 years ago when we were seeing Greta Thunberg amplified by every mainstream Western liberal institution that we would one day hear reports that she has been captured and tormented by the Israeli military for trying to bring formula to starving babies?
Droned flotilla activists and Israel droned flotilla activists and then abused Greta Thunberg. Who would have imagined 5 years ago when we were seeing Greta Thunberg amplified by every mainstream Western liberal institution that we would one day hear reports that she has been captured and tormented by the Israeli military for trying to bring formula to starving babies? The Guardian reports the following. In an email sent by the Swedish Foreign Ministry to people close to Thunberg and seen by The Guardian, an official who has visited the activist in prison said she claimed she was detained in a cell infested with bedbugs, with too little food and water. The embassy has been able to meet with Greta, reads the email. She informed of dehydration. She has received insufficient amounts of both food and water. She also stated that she had developed rashes, which she suspects were caused by bedbugs. She spoke of harsh treatment and said she had been sitting for long periods on hard surfaces. Another detainee reportedly told another embassy that they had seen her, Thunberg, being forced to hold flags while pictures were taken. She wondered whether images of her had been distributed, the Swedish ministry's official added. The allegation was corroborated by at least two other members of the flotilla who had been detained by Israeli forces and released on Saturday. They dragged little Greta by her hair before our eyes, beat her, and forced her to kiss the Israeli flag. They did everything imaginable to her, as a warning to others, the Turkish activist Ersin Selik, a participant in the Sumud flotilla, told Andalo News Agency. Lorenzo D'Agostino, a journalist and another flotilla participant, said after returning to Istanbul that Thunberg was wrapped in the Israeli flag and paraded like a trophy, a scene described with disbelief and anger by those who witnessed it. End quote. These reports, as shocking as they are, also happen to more or less reflect exactly what the Israeli regime said it intended to do to the global Sumud flotilla activists when they were captured. Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said last month that Sumud activists must be treated as terrorists in order to, quote, create a clear deterrent from future flotilla activism, declaring that anyone who chooses to collaborate with Hamas and support terrorism will meet a firm and unyielding response from Israel. Ben-Gvir said at the time, "We will not allow individuals who support terrorism to live in comfort. They will face the full consequences of their actions." After the flotilla activists were abducted by the IDF, Ben-Gvir filmed himself taunting them and calling them terrorists. Israel, needless to say, has an extensively documented record of torturing and abusing individuals who've been given the terrorist label by the regime. So it would appear that they singled out the most high-profile activist on the flotilla for abuse in order to send a message and deter future efforts to break the siege on Gaza. This comes as CBS News publishes a report confirming what we've been saying since last month, that Israel launched multiple drone attacks against the Global Samud flotilla. Citing two U.S. intelligence officials, CBS reports that Benjamin Netanyahu personally authorized attacks in which drones were deployed from an Israeli submarine to drop incendiary devices onto the boats to set them on fire. Israel has been documented using quadcopter drones to drop incendiary firebombs on tents and buildings in Gaza. Last month, Trump's Middle East envoy, Tom Barrack, casually admitted during an interview that Israel is attacking Tunisia, which was where the boat carrying Greta Thunberg was docked during their first drone attack. Like the report on the mistreatment of Thunberg, these drone attacks would also fit in perfectly with the Israeli government's depraved and cynical decision to treat the flotilla activists as terrorists. After the initial claims of a drone attack on the flotilla, the information ecosystem was flooded with Hasperists claiming it was ridiculous to blame Israel for the attacks, and that the fire hadn't come from a drone at all. Odious genocide propagandist Eyal Yacobi got nearly 10 million views on a tweet where he falsely claimed to have video evidence showing that the fire was actually the result of a misfired flare from one of the boat's crew members. Anyone who'd actually watched the video would have seen that it showed nothing of the sort, but because Yacobi inserted a narrative above the video claiming it shows that, I had people in my Twitter notifications telling me for days that it had been conclusively proven the fire was started by a flare. I encountered even some solid Palestine supporters expressing doubt about the drone attacks when the reports first emerged, because it seemed too heinous to be believed. But this just goes to show that there really is nothing you can put past these freaks. Israel and its apologists lie about everything. Everything, everything, everything. We are far past the point where it is reasonable to give Israel the benefit of the doubt when we hear reports that it has done something evil. If you'll launch drone attacks on activists trying to bring aid to starving civilians, there's nothing you won't do.